been great to be there in person, but unfortunately that didn't work out. So what I'm going to talk about today is, I'll start off with a few examples of how topology shows up in condensed matter systems, a few general examples. Then I'll focus on two more specific examples, that is of Majorana modes in topological insulator and superconductor systems and Weyl semimetals. So before I start, I'd like to acknowledge all the people I've worked with. First of all, my advisor, Ashwin Vishwanath, for all the advice and the guidance. And all my collaborators on the projects that I'm presenting today. Puyan Ghaimi, who is now at UIUC. Roger Monk, who just visited Perimeter. I think he just left today morning. And Sid Parmeshwaran, who's a postdoc at UC Berkeley right now. So here's an outline of my talk. So as I said, I'll start off by mentioning how topology shows up in condensed matter systems in general. Then I'll focus on two more specific examples. One is how to combine topological insulators and superconductors cleverly to get Majorana mode states in them. And the second example is that of a fairly new kind of material called Weyl semimetals. So I'll introduce what these materials are and then explain some transport calculations that we did on them. And that's this will start the first section, the introduction. So traditionally, in condensed matter systems, topology showed up in real space in the form of topological defects, such as domain walls, where an order parameter suddenly changes sign. So what I've shown in the figure is a domain wall in a ferromagnet. Going one dimension higher, vortices are common topological defects that are very important to the physics of superconductors and superfluids. And going up another dimension, one can imagine textures in the order parameter that look like hedgehogs. So these are three-dimensional order parameters, and they have a hedgehog-like texture. In some sense, they are a one-dimensional higher version of a vortex. But topology also shows up in momentum space in many condensed matter systems. So one way in which it shows up is through phases such as the integer quantum Hall state, topological insulators and topological superconductors. So what's common to all these systems is that they are all gapped. They have an energy gap in their dispersion in their spectrum. So they have an energy gap in their dispersion, and one can define topological invariants that are that can be obtained by integrating some quantity made up of their wave functions over the whole Brillouin zone or the entire momentum space. So they have something topologically non-trivial about their band structures. Another way in which topology can show up is through singularities in the electronic dispersion. So the Fermi surface or line nodes or point nodes are all examples of singularities in the dispersion. And by defining an appropriate surface in momentum space that surrounds the singularity, it's possible to give a topological perspective to these singularities. And later in the talk, I'll say more about Weyl semimetals, which are in fact examples of systems which have these singularities. And I'll say what is topological about them. And of course, combining topology in real and momentum space gives some more interesting physics. So recently we worked out an example where an order parameter, the order parameter in a topological insulator superconductor system could be given a hop texture. And that showed some interesting physics. This texture behaved as a fermion, as if it were a fermion. For the purpose of this talk, vortices in P plus IP superconductors and a vortex in a superconductor that's deposited on top of a topological insulator will be very relevant, quite important. The reason is both these systems are known to carry Majorana zero modes. And Majorana zero modes are in fact the main subject of the first part of the talk. So with that, I'll come to the first focus example. To start off, let me quickly review what topological insulators are and some general physics about them. Without going into too much detail. So they can be defined as systems that are insulating in the bulk, but they have surface states inside the bulk band gap that are protected by time reversal symmetry. And typically these surface states have a linear dispersion and they can be modeled by a pseudo-relativistic Hamiltonian at low energies. And another thing that I want to mention at this point is that that the surface states have very strong spin-orbit coupling. In fact, the spin-orbit coupling is maximal, that is, the spin is tied to the momentum. So if an electron goes around the Fermi surface, the spin winds around by 2 pi and this state has a very phase of pi around the Fermi surface. So suppose you are given a block Hamiltonian or given some real material, how do you tell if it's a topological insulator or not? You can do that in two simple ways. An appropriate quantity that is defined for this purpose is a Z2 invariant, which is normally called mu naught. It can take on two values, minus one or plus one. If it's minus one, it's a topological insulator. If it's plus one, it's a trivial insulator. And the way you calculate this invariant is either by looking at the surface. If the surface has an odd number of Dirac nodes, then the system is a topological insulator. Or you can calculate it by looking at the bulk band structure, the bulk wave functions. In general, this is not very straightforward, but if the bulk has inversion symmetry, then it turns out there's a very simple criterion for determining this invariant. So all you have to do is look at the parities of the occupied bands at the time reversal invariant momenta, that is, momentum points where k is the same as minus k. So such as 0, 0, 0 or points where k and minus k differ by reciprocal lattice vector are time reversal invariant momenta. So the prescription is that you look at the occupied states at these momenta and look at their parity eigenvalues and multiply them together. And if the product is minus one, again, it's a topological insulator. It's plus one, it's a trivial insulator. So let me quickly illustrate the second point in some detail, because that will be important for a later part of the talk. So let's look at two time reversal invariant momenta. We call them 000 and 005. And let's say the valence band is S-like, and the unoccupied, the conduction band is P-like. So the states at the top of the valence band at the 2.000 and 005 have both even parities. So the topological invariant mu naught is the product of these parities, so it's plus one. On the other hand, if somehow one of these time reversal invariant momenta, the two states at the band edges, the one at the top of the valence band and the one at the bottom of the conduction band, somehow exchange places. Now the occupied band here at the 000 point, the occupied state has odd parity, and therefore the product of the parities is minus one, and that gives a topological insulator. The reason I spent some time on this is because although we are looking at a topological property, something that is defined over the whole Brillouin zone or all of momentum space, a lot of the action, in fact, most of the action is happening only around this time reversal invariant momentum. And the states far away from it are largely untouched. So just by changing the properties around this point, we've changed it. It's possible to change the topology of the system. So a very important reason why this field of topological insulators gained so much mileage is because a number of materials have been discovered experimentally and many more predicted theoretically to be in this space. The early materials were bismuth based, but now there are several more families of materials. So what we are interested in is how to get a Majorana mode starting from a topological insulator. And for that purpose, let me define what a Majorana mode is, how it can appear in a superconductor. So by definition, a Majorana fermion, a Majorana particle is a particle that is its own antiparticle. Now the BDG Hamiltonian, the Bogoliubov-Dejean Hamiltonian for a superconductor has a built-in particle hole symmetry. The Hamiltonian is set up in such a way that the spectrum always has an E to minus E symmetry. So for every state at some energy, it has a conjugate at minus E. So therefore, if there is a single state at zero energy, it has to be its own conjugate. And that by definition is a Majorana mode. That's a Majorana state. And there is no way to move this state away from zero energy because it does not have a partner. The only way it can be moved off zero is by bringing in another Majorana mode from some other part of the system, bringing it close together and pairing these two Majorana modes up. And then they both can get non-zero energies. Otherwise, there is no way to remove it from zero. So several systems exist, or several systems have been predicted to host Majorana zero modes. I mentioned the first two a while ago. Vortices in P plus IP superconductors and on a surface superconductor on a topological insulator surface. Since then, several heterostructures made up of semiconductors and superconductors in some very clever geometries have also been predicted to host Majorana modes. And another example in a slightly different but related context is the 5-hour fractional quantum Hall state. So it turns out if it is in this so-called Moore-Reed state, it can have Majorana zero modes. But for this talk, I'll focus on the proposal of Fu and Kane on depositing a superconductor on top of a topological insulator. So I'll go over that in some detail before motivating the question that we want to answer in our work. Or after explaining that, I'll come to the question that we answered in our work. So what Fu and Kane said was the following. Suppose you take a topological insulator and put a superconductor on top of it. And now you create a vortex in the superconductor. So you pass a magnetic field through it, half a flux quantum. They showed that the core of such a vortex carries a Majorana zero mode. What we ask is the following. Suppose we don't start with a topological insulator. Instead, we dope this topological insulator so that it is no longer an insulator, it's actually a metal. Now, if you make this metal superconducting, then the whole three-dimensional bulk is superconducting. It's no longer just a surface superconductor. The superconductivity exists throughout the bulk. Now, suppose you create a vortex in this superconductor, the question we asked is there a Majorana mode? Is there anything interesting in the vortex core? And in particular, is there a Majorana mode? And this question is quite pertinent because several dope topological insulators, real materials, have in fact been found to show superconductivity. So the question is, if you create a vortex in these superconductors, does the vortex trap a Majorana mode? The short answer is yes, but there are some conditions that need to be satisfied. And in the remaining part of the section, I'll explain how we arrive at these conditions. So this is how we approach the problem. Let's look at an extreme where the topological insulator is not doped. So it is actually an insulator. It has no bulk Fermi surface, but it has surface states. Now if you introduce superconductivity into the system, that only affects the surface states because simple S-wave superconductivity is essentially a Fermi surface phenomenon. So since there is no bulk Fermi surface, the pairing only affects the surface. So if you create a vortex in that superconductor, this is exactly the same as the system that Fu and Kane studied of depositing a superconductor on top of a topological insulator. So in this case, you expect Majorana modes to exist. In the lower figure, I have marked the Majorana modes by red dots. On the other hand, if you go to the other extreme, that is, if you dope the topological insulator by a huge amount, so you are deep inside the conduction band. Now, since superconductivity, for the most part, S-phase superconductivity only knows about the Fermi surface, it should not know about the fact that far below the Fermi surface, the bands were inverted. And therefore, in this case, the topological insulator should have, so to speak, lost its topologicalness if you are very far away from this band inversion. And in that case, we expect there to be no Majorana zero modes. which means somewhere along the way, as the Fermi level was raised, the Majorana zero mode should have disappeared. So what I've shown in the lower panel is, as you increase the Fermi level, the Majorana modes on opposite surfaces start leaking into the bulk. And at some point, they go all the way through and annihilate each other. And then if you increase the Fermi level further, then there are no Majorana modes anywhere. So the original question of whether a superconductor in a doped topological insulator has Majorana modes in the vortex core now gets refined. And the new, more refined question to ask is, how far do these Majorana modes survive? Up to what critical chemical potential do the Majorana modes survive? This problem can also be looked at in a slightly different way. The vortex in the system, the vortex can be thought of as a one-dimensional system. It is a one-dimensional system. It does not have time reversal symmetry. And topological insulators require strong spin-orbit coupling, so there's no spin-rotation symmetry as well. And these symmetry conditions define what is called class D. And it has been known for a while that a one-dimensional system in class D is characterized by a Z2 topological invariant. The invariant tells you whether the ends of this one-dimensional system have Majorana modes or not. So, as you raise the Fermi level in the problem that we are looking at, the vortex undergoes a topological phase transition. It changes from a topologically non-trivial to a topological trivial state. The non-trivial one has Majorana modes, the trivial one does not have any Majorana modes. So what I've shown in the lower panel is what happens to the vortex dispersion as it goes through this phase transition. In the leftmost figure in the lower panel, the vortex spectrum is fully gapped. But as you raise the Fermi level in the bulk, as you move towards the right, this gap starts becoming smaller and smaller. And at some point, which I've shown in the middle figure, the gap closes completely. And this is where the Majorana modes from opposite surfaces enter the bulk and kill each other. And if you go further to the right, there are no Majorana modes anywhere, no protected Majorana zero modes anywhere. So another way to ask the question that I just posed, was how far do these Majorana modes survive? Another way to ask that is, what is the point, what is the value of the Fermi level when the vortex has two bulk Majorana zero modes? We need two bulk zero modes for for Majorana zero modes from the opposite surfaces to come in and annihilate each other. So what we want to find is the chemical potential where this happens. To answer this question, I'll draw an analogy with a system that is more famous and it is well understood and it is more commonly known. And that is of a P plus IP superconductor. So imagine, let's say we take the system that we're interested in, this vortex and a doped topological insulator. And since momentum is conserved along the Z direction, along the vortex direction, yes. Yes. Right. Sorry, what is maintained through the phase transition? Yes. Okay, that's actually a really good question. So let me go back one more slide. So in the second column, the bulk gap in the in the normal phase is actually vanishing. There is a bulk Fermi surface. So one guess would be that as soon as the Fermi level enters the bulk, the Majorana modes from the opposite surfaces can enter the bulk. However, the vortex is actually not gapless throughout. Since the vortex has a finite size, because of finite size quantization, the vortex has a much smaller gap, a gap that is smaller than like the pairing, which is often called the mini gap. So inside the vortex core, it has it still has quantized states separated by some finite energy, and that ensures that the Majorana modes on the surface cannot go right through. Does that answer the question? So the short answer is the vortex is actually gapped, and it is gapped by finite size quantization because the vortex has a finite size. These are the Károlyi-Degenes metricon states. Yes, in the bulk, the mini gap also vanishes. Okay, so in the second column, the bulk gap in the non-superconducting state vanishes. But in, yes, it is still superconducting, and the vortex has a gap. It has a much smaller gap than delta, than the order parameter, but it has a very small gap. It's of the order of delta squared over E mu. Yes. Okay. Okay. So the vortex goes through a phase transition, and what we want to answer is when the vortex have two bulk zero modes. And to answer that, I'll compare our system with a P plus IP superconductor. So we can break the system into many slices labeled by different KZ eigenvalues because momentum is, there's translation invariance along the vortex. So the standard BDG Hamiltonian looks like this. The pairing appears on the orthogonal part. For a vortex, the pairing can be modeled by some constant times x plus iy, or in momentum space, that is I dou kx minus dou ky. But the P plus IP superconductor has a Hamiltonian which actually looks very similar. The main difference between these, well, one difference between these two Hamiltonians is that position and momentum have switched roles. So if you interchange position and momentum, these two Hamiltonians look very, very similar. Now in the P plus IP superconductor, it is known that if there is some contour, if there is some radius where the diagonal part vanishes, then inserting the pi flux in the superconductor, that is creating a vortex, gives a Majorana zero mode. Now this is a pi flux in real space. For our system, real space has become momentum space. So a pi flux in momentum space corresponds to a pi periphase. So the Fermi surface is a surface where the diagonal part of the BDG Hamiltonian vanishes, the expectation value vanishes. And we expect a Majorana zero mode when a certain periphase becomes pi, just by comparing it with the P plus IP superconductor. So on this slide, I've been slightly imprecise just for the sake of making the argument simpler. But in the next couple of slides, I'll make this more rigorous and tell you what exactly goes on. So if you take a system, a non-superconducting system that has time reversal and inversion symmetry, so then you can easily show that every band is doubly degenerate. And now because every band is doubly degenerate, the Berry connection is now a 2x2 Hermitian matrix. It's no longer just a number. And therefore, for each KZ slice, you can define a Berry phase on the Fermi surface. So you go around this 2D contour around the Fermi surface for each KZ slice. And the Berry phase factor is also no longer just a number. It's no longer just a complex phase. It's actually an SU2 matrix. So it turns out because the Berry connection is 2x2, it's the Berry connection at different K points do not commute. So you have to define the Berry phase through this path ordering operator. which is some detail. But the important point is that the Berry phase factor is some SU2 matrix. And because of time reversal and inversion symmetries, you can show that the U1 part of this matrix vanishes. So it's SU2, not U2. And overall phase factor can be removed. So because it's an SU2 quantity, eigenvalues are of this form, e to the I phi and e to the minus I phi. And with that, I come to a main result for when this vortex phase transition occurs. The result is, what I've written down here is the spectrum, the vortex spectrum. So I'm now, I've taken the system, this non-superconducting system, added superconductivity and created a vortex in it. For this vortex, the spectrum looks like this. It is the energy eigenvalues are discrete, labeled by different n, which are integers. And the Berry phase of the normal state Fermi surface enters the spectrum as a parameter. And clearly, if the Berry phase is pi, then the spectrum has zero modes. So if the Berry phase is pi, that is when the vortex undergoes this phase transition. The gap closes, which I've shown on the right, or the Majorana modes go right through, which I've shown on the left. And note that because the Berry phase is an SU2 quantity, these always appear in pairs. So remember, we were looking for exactly two bulk zero modes. And because the Berry phase is an SU2 quantity, you'll always get zero modes in sets of two. You won't get a single zero mode. So just to point out that this is the right count, right number of states we want. This is not quite the full story. There is just one more point that actually simplifies life a lot, which is, again, because of time reversal or inversion symmetry, these eigenvalues are the same at kz and minus kz. So if you're at a non-zero kz, if a vortex phase transition happens at a certain non-zero kz, it also happens at minus kz, which means at non-zero kz's, you'll always get groups of four Majorana zero modes, bulk zero modes, which is too much. We are looking for two or six or 10 or 14 or so on, but not multiples of four. So therefore, it is only sufficient to look at kz equals zero or pi. And that is what we look at. And with that, we now have a prescription for determining whether a vortex in a doped topological insulator has Majorana modes or not, surface Majorana modes or not. The answer is you just take the Bloch Hamiltonian and calculate the SU2 Berry phase as a function of the doping, as a function of the Fermi level. And at the point where this Berry phase has eigenvalues pi, pi, a vortex phase transition occurs. So if you are below that chemical potential, there are Majorana zero modes. If you are above that chemical potential, these Majorana modes are managed. So we use that criterion and applied that to some real materials. So among some dope topological insulators, which are known to be superconducting, we found that these materials actually do carry Majorana zero modes. It turns out that for these materials, life is actually even simpler. It turns out you don't actually have to go through this Berry phase calculation. There is a simpler way to, there's a simplification that occurs which tells you they have Majorana modes. And I'll be happy to tell you more about that later if you're interested. For the most famous example of copper doped bismuth selenide, we calculated this Berry phase as for various vortex directions. And we found that if the vortex is along the c-axis, the Berry phase is very close to, the critical chemical potential is very close to the chemical potential in the experimental system. So what I've done in this figure is the Berry phase eigenvalues as a function of the chemical potential for two different vortex directions. So if the vortex is along the c-axis, we are very close to the critical point. But if you go, if the vortex is tilted into the AB plane, it turns out the critical chemical potential is higher. So we expect to see Majorana zero modes there. Now, if you go back, note that if you think about it, you might realize that we didn't actually use the fact that we started with the topological insulator. All we cared about was the fact that the berry phase had to become pi, had to have eigenvalues of pi, which means if you take a system that has two band inversions, and suppose you fix your chemical potential at a value such that the vortex phase transition has occurred at one of these band inversion points, but not at the other one. Then a superconductor vortex in such a system should have Majorana Riemann. Although it's not a topological insulator, it has two band inversions, so it's a weak topological insulator or a trivial insulator. You can mask one of these band inversions and sort of fool the system into believing that it's topological, and then you expect to get Majorana Riemann. So in fact, there are some sets of materials, lead telluride and thin telluride, germanium telluride, which have four band inversions related to each other. So they are all trivial insulators. However, if one can fix the chemical potential at a value such that one or three of these band inversions are masked, and then a vortex in that superconductor in the subsequent superconductor should carry Majorana Riemann. And these materials have actually been known to show superconductivity. So that's a very promising direction. So with that, let me summarize the results on Majorana modes. So what we showed that if you take a dope topological insulator and make it superconducting, a vortex in that superconductor traps Majorana Riemann on the surface, provided the doping is below some threshold. And the value of that threshold is tied to some berry phase properties of the Fermi surface in the normal state. And we applied that criterion we applied that on the block Hamiltonians known for some real materials, and found that some of those actually are expected to carry Majorana modes. So with that, I'll flash the last slide of the first section, which is what are the open questions in this field. So we assume that the bulk insulator had inversion symmetry. The undoped state insulator or the metal had inversion symmetry, and that was a very important point in our calculation. So a natural question to ask is, what happens if the insulator breaks inversion? What happens to that criterion? We can look at other geometries. Instead of imagining a vortex in the superconductor, let's imagine a domain wall. So if you only have a surface superconductor, there's no superconductivity in the bulk, and somehow make the phase of the superconductor change by pi, then you can show that along the domain wall, there are Majorana modes. Now these are propagating Majorana modes. So you get a Majorana wire along the domain wall. Now suppose you dope this system, what is the point where these Majorana wires disappear? That's a question to ask. And the broader question is, what if the pairing is actually P wave? So we assume throughout that the pairing was ordinary S wave. But there have been some proposals which suggest that the pairing could actually be odd parity. So what happens, what is the physics like in that case? So after that, I'll end the first section and start the second part of my talk, which is on wild semi-metals. I'll quickly introduce them and explain some transport calculations we did. So by definition, wild semi-metals are materials that have, Yes. Here it is an ordinary vortex. Yeah. So actually, the thing is, the parent material does not have spin degeneracy. It does not. It breaks spin rotation symmetry. There's strong spin orbit coupling. Yes. Well, so inversion is still preserved, so you still should not get mixing between odd and even parities in space. There is still inversion symmetry. No, it's not complete. It's just an analogy, just to motivate the result. So there are other differences too. Yes. Yes. Okay, so the when I said the spin direction is tied to the momentum, that was for the surface states. On the surface, the spin is tied to the momentum. In the bulk, of course, there is strong spin orbit coupling, but there is no such spin momentum locking in the bulk. Okay, sure. Yes. Yes. So what happens is the way it enters is you want to ensure that your state, your wave function is single valued as you go around the vortex core. And the single valued, so as you go along the vortex, go around the vortex, there are two phases that enter. One is the very phase which enters the parameter, but the phase that you pick up also depends on the energy. So therefore, to ensure that it is single valued, the very phase and the energy should be related in such a way that that the wave function is single valued, and that gives the relation, the conservation condition. Yes. Okay, so can I go on? So while semi-metals are materials that have three-dimensional band touchings, and close to these band touching points, the dispersion is linear. So if you like, you can think of these as three-dimensional analogs of graphene without the additional spin degeneracies. Now, why do we call them while semi-metals? Because of the following reasons. In ordinary free space, electrons satisfy or fermions satisfy the Dirac equation. The wave function is a four-component spinner, and the Hamiltonian is a 4x4 matrix, and this describes normal fermions. On the other hand, these band touching points have only 2 degrees of freedom, very close to that point. A two-component wave function, a two-component spinner is sufficient to describe the physics very close to these band touching points. And such fermions are described by the Weyl equation. And that is why we call these materials, or that is why these materials are called Weyl semi-metals. And a very important distinction between the Dirac, a very important consequence of the fact that these are only two-component fermions is that there is no way to add a term to the Weyl Hamiltonian to open a gap in the spectrum. So all the three polymatrices have been used up, and there is no fourth polymatrix which anticommutes with all of these. So therefore, there is no mass term that can be added to this Hamiltonian. And note that this is very different from graphene. In graphene, only two of the polymatrices were used in writing the kinetic part. So a third polymatrix was still available to gap the spectrum out. So you cannot add a mass term and gap a while node out. The only way to gap these out is by breaking two of these together and fusing them together. Or if there are processes which scatter between while nodes. But as long as there is good translational symmetry, nice momentum conservation, you cannot gap these while nodes out. And for that fact, these are in some sense topological objects in momentum space. So this is what is topological about while semimetals. And because of that fact, they show some very interesting physics. One consequence of the fact of this protection is that if you have a void semimetal in the geometry of a slab, then the surface of the slab has some very interesting states. It turns out the surface has a Fermi arc which connects the projection of the two void points on the Fermi surface. Note that it's just an open Fermi arc. It's not a closed Fermi surface. It's only half of a Fermi surface. The other half is on the opposite surface. Another interesting effect is what's called the chiral anomaly. This is quite well known in the integer quantum Hall state. You can get a chiral anomaly through the edge states. So in the Weyl semimetals, you can get a higher dimensional version of the chiral anomaly. You can also think of these Weyl semimetals as surface states of a four-dimensional churn insulator. Again, going two dimensions, it's a higher dimensional version of the integer quantum Hall effect, going up by two dimensions. So if these Weyl nodes cannot talk to each other at all, then you can think of these as being on different surfaces of a four-dimensional system. And finally, well, not finally, but another important reason why these could gain some mileage is because there have been some material prediction for these Weyl semimetals. Some of these materials, the pyrochlorates, already exist. They've been around for a long time. And some recent work has predicted these and some other systems to realize this Weyl semimetal phase. So what we did was do some transport calculations in this phase. So just by dimension analysis, the conductivity is E squared over H times some inverse length scale. The question to ask is, what is this is length scale? So we calculated the conductivity in two different cases. One was in the presence of Coulomb interactions, but no disorder, just Coulomb interactions. And we did the calculation at very low frequencies. So in this regime, when the frequency is much smaller than alpha squared, alpha is the fine structure constant, the effective fine structure constant. When the frequency is less than that times temperature, the transport is dominated by collisions between the electrons. And we calculated the conductivity by setting up a quantum Boltzmann equation and solving it within a leading log approximation. I'll say more about what all this means. Especially what this leading log approximation and how we set up this quantum Boltzmann equation. I'll say more about that in the following slides. We also calculated transport in the presence of simple chemical potential disorder. We assumed point scatterers and used a Born approximation to calculate the self energy of the lifetime and found the conductivity by evaluating a Cooper formula. So let me first talk about transport with Coulomb interactions. Now for generic Fermi surfaces, a state that has non-zero current also has non-zero momentum. So therefore, if there is no disorder in the system, there are only interactions, only processes that conserve the total momentum, there is no way to relax this state to a state where the total momentum is zero. So therefore, if you apply an electric field, you can get block oscillations, but you won't get an actual current. On the other hand, if you have a system that has particle hole symmetry, such as a Dirac dispersion at charge neutrality, or any linear dispersion, some dispersion at charge, or Weyl dispersion at charge neutrality. Here, the state I've depicted here has a non-zero current, but the total momentum is zero. So therefore, in this system, you don't need disorder to relax the current. Only interactions, only momentum conserving processes are sufficient. And therefore, you can expect to get a non-zero current only with interactions. This is how we go about calculating the current, calculating the conductivity with Coulomb interactions. So by definition, or in this regime where the frequency is very small, the conductivity is just the sum of the electron and hole parts, and can be written in this form that I've written here. What we want is this distribution function f of k, comma k at time t. The distribution function is expected to satisfy a quantum Boltzmann equation. The quantum part of this equation is the right hand side, where the scattering rate is determined not within a relaxation time approximation, but by using Fermi's golden rule. So we look at all these diagrams and calculate the net rate at which particles enter the state at k at time t. So that is the quantum part of this Boltzmann equation. So this in general gives a very complicated integral equation, which is impossible to solve in general. However, a lot of progress can be made if this integral equation is reformulated as a variational problem. Because the Coulomb interactions go as 1 over q squared in momentum space, it's clear that it's only the small q scattering processes that should dominate the transport. And therefore, to solve this variational problem, we choose an ansatz that gives more importance to this process. In fact, it almost picks out these processes compared to the others. So using that ansatz, we use that ansatz and make a further approximation, which is known as the leading log approximation. Just say a few quick words about that. So it turns out that the q part of the integral over q is of the form dq over q, so which has log divergences at both 0 and infinity. However, what the leading log approximation says is that these divergences can be cut off. The upper limit is the temperature, because that is the highest energy scale in this problem. So, and the Fermi functions become very small when you go higher than the temperature. So the upper limit can safely be set to the temperature. For the lower limit, we pick it as alpha t. And the reason for that is the following. Although the Coulomb interactions are unscreened, we are working with unscreened Coulomb interactions, which goes 1 over q squared. There is still some thermal screening. So at a finite temperature, electrons and holes are excited, and you have a plasma which can interact and thermally screen these Coulomb interactions. And that screening length is the screening wave vector should be alpha times t, because that is the energy scale, and alpha tells you how strong the interactions are. So within the leading log approximation, we replace the integral limits by t alpha and t respectively. And therefore, this integral over q, which was log divergent to start with, becomes equal to log of alpha inverse. And in the rest of the integrand, we set q to 0. So that's called the leading log approximation. One more point I want to make about that is, this approximation works well in 3 dimensions, but in 2 dimensions, it actually turns out to fail. So you have to do some more work to do all this in 2 dimensions. So using that, we found this following result that I have displayed here for the conductivity. So the inverse length scale I mentioned a few slides ago. Here, the inverse length scale is now the temperature. So it's possible to understand this, the DC limit, the zero frequency limit of this result in a simple form. So since at non-zero temperatures there's a thermally excited plasma consisting of electrons and holes, we can apply the Einstein relation which relates the conductivity to the diffusion constant. So the diffusion constant, which is the velocity times the mean free path, is Vf squared tau. Tau involves the scattering rate is equal to n. N here is the number of wild nodes times alpha squared times t. So the scattering rate should be proportional to the number of wild nodes, because if you have more wild nodes, you get more scattering, just in very simple terms. Then the scattering matrix elements, the scattering is proportional to the square of the matrix elements of the scattering processes, and therefore it is proportional to alpha squared. And temperature is the only energy scale in the DC limit, so it should be proportional to the temperature. So that's the scattering rate, and dN by d mu is the density of states. And that's proportional to t squared. So just using the Einstein relation and these approximation or these estimates for the scattering time, you get the conductivity to be of this form. If you look carefully, this is very similar to the form I've written up here in the DC limit, except for this factor of log alpha. So almost the correct answer. None. That's a way to understand the answer that we got. One more small point that I want to make is the fine structure constant and the velocity that one must use in calculating the conductivity at some temperature should be their renormalized values at temperature T. The velocity and the fine structure constant undergo some renormalization when you change the temperature. So you should use the renormalized values. The charge E does not get renormalized because of gauge invariance. That's just a minor point. So using those results, we compared using that result, we compared our prediction with some real experimental data. So this experiment was performed on several pyrochloriridates back in 2001. And what I plotted on the right is a comparison between the theory and experiment. The blue curve is the experimental curve, the red one is the theoretical curve, and it's clear that they are quite close to each other. So there's a fairly good match. So this suggests that the transport in these pyrochloriridates, or in fact in Y semimetals, is probably dominated by Coulomb interactions. We also looked at transport in the presence of disorder. So I'll just quickly explain what we did in just one slide. So we first calculated the self-energy or the lifetime using a simple Born approximation. And the Kubo and the conductivity was evaluated using a Kubo formula. So what I've drawn on the right, the double lines on the right are to indicate that we use the Drest propagators, which the Green's function including the self-energy. And that gave us the result. So what I've plotted here is the conductivity as a function of frequency. All this can almost be done analytically, only this last part, the last integration, requires some little bit of numerics. Just want to draw your attention to the fact that in this plot, on the y-axis, the scale is linear, but on the x-axis, it's actually a log scale. So I want to draw your attention to two regimes in this plot. One is where the frequency is much smaller than the temperature. The frequency is very small, that is the DC limit. So in the DC limit, the conductivity, it turns out, collapses to some universal number, and this number, well, universal in the sense that it only depends on the strength of the disorder, which is parameterized by this quantity gamma. So all these curves which are at different temperatures all collapse to this point. So if the conductivity as a function of frequency has a Drude peak, and it turns out that the Drude peak has a width that's proportional to t squared, and just to remind you, the number of wild nodes, the number of flavors. On the other hand, in the high frequency limit, the conductivity becomes independent of temperature and only depends on the frequency. So again, all these curves collapse onto just one curve. And just to reiterate, the conductivity is only determined by some inverse length scale or by some energy scale. And all these results are sort of confirm that. So in the low frequency regime, the inverse length scale is decided by the disorder strength. In the high frequency regime, the inverse length scale or the energy scale is the frequency. So if you want to look at the conductivity at low frequency and at low temperature, it's very important to take the right order of limits, omega going to zero and temperature going to zero, because the results are very different in the two limits. So with that, I'll summarize the transport calculations we did on wild semi-metals. So we first looked at transport in the presence of Coulomb interactions. We found the conductivity by setting up a quantum Boltzmann equation. We converted that to a variational problem and used a leading log approximation to solve it. The result was that the DC conductivity was proportional to the temperature, and that fitted quite well with the experimental data. On the other hand, we also looked at conductivity in the presence of disorder, which was parameterized by some number gamma. The strength of the disorder was parameterized by gamma. The behavior was very different in the low frequency and high frequency regimes. At low frequency, the conductivity had a drew the peak, or the height of the peak was set by the disorder strength and the width was set by the temperature. And in the high frequency regime, the conductivity was proportional to the frequency, independent of temperature. And this is a very new field. The first prediction that the pyrochloridates were wild semi-metals only came out about a year ago. So there are still many open questions in this field. One of them is, I mentioned 4p arc surface states for these wild semi-metals. So the surface had these weird half Fermi surfaces. So a natural question is, do these show any quantum oscillations which are different from ordinary Fermi surfaces? And we are actually working on that right now. I also mentioned a chiral anomaly. So another natural question is, how do you see this chiral anomaly in an experiment? Does it do and show any interesting physics, any interesting experimentally measurable consequences? So combining topological insulators with superconductors gave a lot of new interesting physics. What happens if you combine wild semi-metals with superconductors? Is there anything new there? So it's not an insulator, it's a very different kind of material from a topological insulator. But it's just an open question and be nice to all get out. Also, the materials that have been predicted to be wild semi-metals so far are not very good for cleaving. They have a cubic symmetry, and therefore it's not very easy to cleave clean surfaces. And to do experiments such as ARPES, you need very clean surfaces. An ARPES experiment, a photo emission experiment, can easily see those Fermi arcs. But if you cannot get a very clean surface, then it's hard to do such an experiment. So it would be nice if more such materials could be found. And there are many more questions, open questions too. So let me mention a few other, just to wind up, I'll mention a few other projects that I've been working on or have worked on in the past. So I'm collaborating with an experimental group at UC Berkeley, the group of Dan Stamperger. They have a way to create an optical Kagome lattice and put bosons in that lattice. And there are some promising new physics there. It's a highly tunable system, so there's a lot that you can do with it. I also studied the effects of shining circularly polarized light on the surface of a topological insulator. And so shining light generates a photocurrent in general. Here it generates a photocurrent. And I calculated that current, and it turned out that the current had some interesting features. It turned out to depend on the Berry curvature of the surface bands, which I thought was quite cool. In another collaboration, we looked at a topological insulator superconductor system. The topological insulator here was insulating, it was not doped. And one could define an order parameter consisting of the topological insulator gap and the complex superconductor, the complex pairing parameter. So using this three component order parameter, it's possible to create what's called a hop texture in this order parameter. So it's a fully gapped system. It has no defects, but it's a topologically non-trivial texture. And it turns out that with such a texture, this texture has fermionic statistics. It acts like a fermion. And one other project that I worked on some time ago was looking at a 3D Dirac dispersion, not a wild dispersion, Dirac dispersion. So there are multiple copies. The point, the nodes are degenerate. And looking for ways to open a gap in that spectrum and seeing what different phases we can get. So we found several phases, some were trivial, some we found several topological insulating and topological superconducting phases. And we studied relations between those phases. We created defects in those phases and found that the defects are related through a certain duality relationship and besides other things. So here are the references. If you're interested, you should take a look. And with that, I'll end my talk. And here are the references for the results I presented. And thank you. Thanks a lot for your attention.
Thanks, Pawan.
Oh, hi, Dima.
I turned my mic back on. Actually, I have a couple of questions.
Yes.
So first question is, what are the conditions for the localization of the electrons in wild semi-metals? Essentially, what kind of disorders do you need to localize electrons?
Yeah. What kind of disorder you need?
Right.
So I think as long as any disorder that can scatter between the two wild nodes, I think can localize. I don't think there is anything protecting localization against processes that can scatter between the wild nodes.
I see. Because for example, in graphene, you need the disorder which takes you between different valleys, right? So if your disorder scatters you only within a single valley,
yes,
then turns out you have weak anti-localization.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but if you if the disorder is really short range and you can scatter between different valleys, then you have a crossover to the localization. So I'm wondering, is it similar mm-hmm. for the wild semi metals? Is it similar for this 3D graphene?
Yes. So for this wild semi-metals, a disorder that can only scatter within the valleys will not localize it. I don't know about anti-localization. I've not worked that out. But it will not localize it. But if it can scatter across the two valleys, scatter between valleys, then it should be able to localize it. There's nothing protecting it.
I see. And another question. So you've mentioned that there are some candidate materials, right? Which
yes.
are wild semi-metals.
Yes.
And what is the typical directed constant of those materials? Because you know, many semi-metals, they have very large dielectric constant, right? For example,
mm-hmm.
if you take bismuth has dielectric constant of, if I'm not mistaken, it's over 100. So that makes all the interactions effect very suppressed. Right.
I see.
I'm wondering what is the typical coupling constant, right? What is E squared over epsilon V Fermi in those materials that you mentioned?
Mm-hmm. So I don't know what the value of the dielectric constant is, but in the experimental data that we fitted, the results for the conductivity versus experimental data, it turned out that a dielectric constant of the order of 10 or so fitted the experimental data. So,
I see. So
it could be that, but
I see.
So it could be of that order, but I'm not 100% sure.
Mm-hmm. And actually, let me ask another question.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what is the effect of strain on this while node? Can you generate a gauge field?
Yeah, that's actually a wonderful question, and we're actually thinking about it for a while. You can do very weird things. So I think what you're heading towards is the strain can act like a magnetic field. Is that what you're thinking about? In graphene, you can apply strain which simulates a magnetic field.
So
you can simulate a magnetic field. Now, there are different ways in which you can apply the strain. You can either make the magnetic field point in the same direction in the two while nodes or in opposite directions in the two while nodes.
I see.
Okay. So, in one case, so the while nodes have the zeroth Landau level for the two while nodes disperses in opposite directions if you apply an ordinary magnetic field. Okay, that you can show. They have opposite chirality, so the zeroth Landau level disperses in opposite directions with an ordinary magnetic field. Now, if you apply a weird magnetic field so that both the Landau levels disperse in the same direction, it looks like all the charge will just move in one direction, which sounds very, very weird.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, a partial resolution to that paradox is that they actually move all the way in one direction, but once they come to the surface, because there are these fermions, they can go around and come back from the other side. They can go around the system and come back from the other side.
I see.
So it's very strange,
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, thanks a lot, Pawan. So actually, I'll have to run, but thanks a lot. We'll be in touch. Let's chat some more on Skype maybe next week.
Yes, definitely. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay, yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, bye.
Yes. Well, it seems to be, yes. Between a while semi-metal and an ordinary Dirac metal, right? So actually, a lot of the results are very similar. I recently there was a work which studied the quantum critical point between the transition between a topological insulator and a trivial insulator. So there you have a four-component Dirac node at the critical point. And they did a similar quantum Boltzmann analysis, using leading log approximation. And the conductivity actually has a very similar form. So I think a difference would be in the presence of disorder. So in the presence of disorder, while semi-metals require disorder to scatter between while nodes for localization, only scattering slowly varying disorder, smooth disorder cannot localize the while nodes. But for a Dirac node, that can. There is no such protection. Yes. Yes, there is an E dot B term. Maybe that was one of the open questions. I'm not sure at this stage what a good experiment would be to see that anomaly. Okay, thanks a lot. Thanks for your attention. Hi. Yes. I have time. Okay, sure. Yes, Skype is fine. Can I add you on Skype? Guffey.vidal. Okay, so I'll find you and add you in Skype before you reach your office. Okay, no problem. Okay, thanks. All right. Thanks a lot for organizing. Okay, I can do that.